Ukraine calling.
Were you surprised by the 2019 landslide?
It's a true democracy when you have elections with unpredictable results. I already have experience of negotiating with Russians within the so-called Minsk process. I was deputy head of Ukrainian delegation.
Oh, you were? Wow.
It was easier to negotiate with the wall than with the Russians. Our official position is that we believe in the wisdom of American people, and we are ready to work with anyone who becomes the next president. The 21st century will be a century of struggle between free world and authoritarian world headed by China. For China, defeat of Ukraine would be defeat of the West and United States. This is how they view the geopolitical situation.
Austria, Slovakia, and Hungary. And those are problematic allies in Central Europe. Good day, everybody. This is Brian Bonner, your host for Ukraine Calling. We have a lot of questions, and we have exactly the right guest for it today. Alexander Maresko, Member of Parliament, Chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
Honored to have you in our company. Having a little technical problem, so our screen is not is half the size that it was. So Alexander and I are sitting closer than usual, but that's okay. Alexander, so many questions, and I'll just start. Is the international legal system broken? How disappointed should Ukraine be at not getting an invitation to join NATO? How worried should Ukrainians be about the upcoming U.S. and French elections? Why does Ukraine only have 50 embassies when the world has 190 nations? What should our foreign policy be towards refugees, particularly fighting-age men who are living abroad in different countries? You know, by way of biography, I want to say that you are from Bobrinets. You came, and I heard you explain that you're an accidental politician because your major, your experience is in international law and treaties. You're a lawyer, a jurist, and you've got quite a stellar educational record as an academic. You graduated from Taras Shevchenko National University, but you've also went on to University of Denver. And you also studied at the Harriman Institute and Columbia University, Kennan Institute, and the Woodrow Wilson Center. And so all the top flight think tanks in America. And it's true you speak four languages.
Yes, I've been teaching in four languages.
Actually, you speak five languages then: English, Polish, French, Russian, Ukrainian, of course.
To tell the truth, French is on a very modest level.
I haven't been practicing. Okay, all right. But so multilingual, and we're happy to have you here. You rode the wave of the Zelensky popularity in 2019 and got elected to chosen by your peers to be the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, which is a very key post now during the time of war. I have to ask, before we dive into the substance, where can you do the most good? What have you learned about being a politician? Do you like it more than liking it? Can you be more useful as a politician or as an academic?
Well, it's an extremely interesting question because, you know, I have a feeling all my life I have been academician, a pure, I would say, academician, and I've been international legal scholar. So, and my life was about doing research in the field of international law and teaching international law, of course. But, you know, it's like being a theorist of international law. It's like know the rules, how to play chess, but never actually to play them. But this thing has changed. And being a politician means to be able to play political games and to apply the rules of international law. So to me, it's a unique experience in terms of getting material and experience, which I hopefully later on in my life and career I'll be using when I go back to international legal science. So it's a unique experience, for instance, international organizations. I've been teaching a course on international organizations, but I have never been directly involved and I have never seen it from inside, like, for example, Council of Europe. how it works, or interparliamentary union and other interparliamentary organizations.
United Nations, maybe. Well, I think you're stuck with being a politician, because as long as the full-scale war goes on, as you know, we're not going to have elections, justifiably. I know you've explained that, and I agree that we can't have that. But that sort of makes you a politician with no end date. Unless you resign, you're going to stay with it.
Yes, you know, on the one hand, to be a politician is very interesting and unique life experience. On the other hand, it's something very different from the way of life which I had before and which I miss, honestly. But at the same time, it's also a unique opportunity to try to change something. And especially now in this crucial period of time, I want honestly to be helpful to my country, to my people, and at least I'm trying to do whatever I can to defend Ukraine's interests in this field of interparliamentary communication.
Now let's go with some potential political trouble spots. How worried are you about the U.S. election in November?
Our official position is that we believe in the wisdom of American people, and we are ready to work with anyone who becomes the next president, either Biden or Trump. And for us, what really matters, we call it bipartisan support. And we see that among Republicans, majority of Republicans, they're supporters of, and very active. Some of them are really active supporters of Ukraine. Democrats, most of them are also our friends. So I want to believe that no matter who becomes the president, we'll see continuation of support of Ukraine for a very simple reason, because it's in the national interests, in the best interests of the United States.
Yes, and we've seen a lot of conversion. We were together in Odessa, and I was watching a little bit with horror and shock that your panel, because you were flanked with all pro-Trump Americans, basically, on the panel. And I checked the moderator, Danube Institute, and it's a very pro-Orban, pro-Trump thing. And I asked the moderator afterwards, why did you stack the panel with pro-Trumpists and MAGA? Well, I wanted their views to be heard. And it was a surprise. I thought there'd be at least one Biden there. But you handled it well. You said that it's institutions that matter. And you were right about the Republic. There's a hardcore Reaganite Republican wing of the party that doesn't believe Biden has done enough and gone strong enough. And I know you're too diplomatic to criticize America because you're grateful, but I'm an American, so I can. I agree with the Reagan wing. I also personally believe Trump would be a disaster, but I do believe that people have conversions. And look at House Speaker Mike Johnson. I mean, he went from opposing aid to saying we have to, Ukraine has to win. Same thing with Emmanuel Macron.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think that on our part, it would be a smart policy to have dialogue with let me put it this way, Ukraine skeptics in the United States. Because what is interesting and good about Americans that if you have such a dialogue, you can persuade them. If you put forward persuasive enough arguments, there is a chance that you can bring them on your side.
It raises questions. How do we deal with troublesome countries that are important, like China, like Hungary, like Austria, like Slovakia under Fico? What should be our approach?
I view this issue from the perspective of international lawyer. I think that there is only one thing which can unite all these countries you mentioned and their interests, which is international law. We just should play by the rules established long ago. And it's important because the war of aggression is a flagrant violation of such rules. And each country should be interested. It's even not only moral, it's legal obligation of each country to support and to render help to the victim of the aggression. That's why we need to have a dialogue even with these countries. As for China, it's a sort of separate story, because the 21st century will be a century of struggle between free world and authoritarian world headed by China. And the United States is the leader of free world and democracy. And of course, I view Ukraine only on the side of this free world. And what we are doing, we are fighting not only for our territorial integrity, we are fighting for democracy. Broadly speaking. And China is the biggest danger to democracy. Now China is helping a lot Russia to survive and to continue a war.
Not neutral in your view?
Absolutely. China is not neutral. How can it be neutral if it officially it is strategic partner without limits with Russia? And it helped Russia to restore its military-industrial complex. It's doing everything it can to help Russia. It's not interested.
It looks like they want to defeat the West more than they want global rule of law.
Absolutely. For China, defeat of Ukraine would be defeat of the West and United States. This is how they view the geopolitical situation. That's why situation in Ukraine, Russian aggression is Ukraine, is something much bigger than just a war of one country against the other.
So we're right to call them out on that. Now, international law. Okay, you're the scholar, but I see the international legal institutions as broken because they were unable to. They are unable to prevent war in any shape or fashion, and we have yet to see whether they are capable of punishing war crimes. We don't know that yet, and Ukraine is going to be a big test case on this issue. And you know very well, better than I do, that the whole architecture of the United Nations, it's a World War II creature, and it's alienating a lot of nations, that the world has changed completely, and yet we have these same five nations that can block everything. So I wanted to maybe, let's talk about the latest news and how that applies to what I just said. As you know, the European Court of Human Rights has ruled that Russia violated human rights, committed war crimes during 10 years of occupation in Crimea. What did you think of the findings? Have you read them? Were you involved in their work?
I was not involved, but I'm familiar with this decision. Of course, as a lawyer, I need to read it more carefully. But I just know the general information which was released by the press. It's a victory for international law, and it creates a very powerful argument in support of Ukraine. But of course, you know, the problem with international law is the problem of its implementation. For example, we might have a decision of the ICJ, International Court of Justice, or arrest warrants of the International Criminal Court, or decision of the European Court of Human Rights. But the key question is how to get it implemented. And this is the problem, because so far, international law, it's a very peculiar system, legal system. It's based on self-help principle. But at the same time, it also relies on legal culture of different countries. And of course, if we take Russia, it's a country which doesn't respect international law, even though it makes references. It tries to hide its aggression.
It doesn't respect any law. But
yeah, exactly.
I mean, it seems broken, and you're right. I mean, individual nations just opt out, like, you know, Russia doesn't respect the International Criminal Court. Russia doesn't respect the international justice or the European Court of Human Rights. They just said, okay, we're taking our ball and going home. Is it even possible to have an international enforcement mechanism, or is that just too far off into the future to think about?
It is possible. Interestingly enough, a good example of how it should be done, we can find in such a document as the League of Nations Covenant. There is an article about aggressive war, what should be done in such cases, and the answer is very simple. Total isolation of the aggressor.
Automatic,
yes, to sever even private ties. Mm-hmm. You know, unfortunately, Russia remains not completely isolated economically.
Nope, they got their friends.
Yes, and even diplomatically. But ideally, to implement international law against the aggressor, it would be to sever all, at least the West should sever all the contacts with the aggressor, including economic ties. But yeah. Unfortunately, some Western countries continue to buy Russian gas.
And yeah, Austria, I'll name them. If you want Austria, Slovakia, and Hungary. And those are problematic allies in Central Europe. You've talked that Russia's an illegitimate member of the United Nations. That brings a lot of, and I know we talked about, I think we both read John Bolton's book. Some people just want to just remake the United Nations from the ground up. Are you in that camp?
To be more specific, with some hesitation, but I'm in that camp for a very simple reason, because, you know, the whole geopolitical situation has dramatically changed. To give you an example, among permanent members of Security Council, there is no such countries as India, the biggest country, the biggest democracy. There is no African state. And Security Council was constructed many, many years ago as a result of the Second World War. But since that time, global politics has changed dramatically.
Populations, politics. This might be a good segue into your, like, back, bringing back a little bit. I was surprised. I mean, I had Ambassador at Large Alexander Sherba here on the program. I'm surprised that we have embassies only in 50 or so nations out of 190. And the war has shown us that where our weak spots are in the global south. Ken, is it important to have diplomatic missions everywhere in the world? And you know as well as I do, when it comes to budget during a war, the defense ministry gets the money and diplomacy often gets the short shrift, not just in Ukraine, but also in America, the State Department, compared to the budget. Is this a priority for you? Is it important to have diplomatic representation in almost all countries?
It is a priority. If we take the UN, there are 193 member states. So ideally, it would be great to have in each of these countries, except for the aggressor state and its allies, of course, our representation, our diplomatic mission. But so far, we can afford to have 50. But what we are doing, we are trying to enlarge. For instance, in Africa, recently we have opened, and I mean Ukraine has opened and planning to open more embassies. Some ambassadors, they perform simultaneously their functions in a number of states. For instance, an ambassador to the South African Republic, she is also simultaneously ambassador at around a dozen of other African states, which is a huge burden, I understand, but we're trying to create more new embassies. But at the same time, we're limited in terms of budget. And additionally, a crucial factor in such decisions to open or not to open embassy in a particular country is whether we have strong ties, economic connections, because there are some distant countries with which we don't have many, we don't have intensive kind of connections.
If you had, can you name the top five countries where you think we need an embassy where we don't have now, or have you not thought that far?
Mostly African countries and global south.
Because of the population.
Because of Latin America. I would also mention Latin America because we are fighting for and trying to persuade our partners of the other country in the global south to support us. That's why we need to have our embassies.
I hope that goes through, because I think for the budget, I think the foreign ministry does a pretty good job. Let's talk about refugees, particularly. It seems that Ukraine has, for practical reasons, decided to give up persuading refugees to come back because it's useless until the war is over. But there's a particular category of fighting age men, and it's becoming an irritant, their presence in some of the countries of our friends like Poland. What do you think about that? And what should our message be to those countries that are hosting these men?
Yes, I heard from my Polish colleagues, for example, such sort of complaints regarding when they see young men of the conscription age sitting in restaurants, it causes some, it begs some questions on their part. Yes, it's obvious. But the truth is that these people, they came on different grounds, on different, it's difficult to sort of generalize. And another issue is that there are no legal mechanisms on the part of Ukraine how to make some of these men, for example, to come back to Ukraine. So it's a difficult issue. There are also some men who came to other countries before the full-scale invasion, and they had sometimes families, sometimes jobs in these countries. So it's difficult to come up with one solution. But at the same time, for instance, I remember how the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, he called upon men, Ukrainian men who live now abroad to come back and to fight. Yes, it's but it's more a moral obligation as of now. But of course, I believe that we should try to create incentives within the country to persuade these people to come back.
That's good. Financial incentives, moral incentives, or just power of persuasion? Because we do need more soldiers, that's for sure.
Yes.
And they need weapons and they need training.
For example, professional incentives. If a person comes back and fights, defends the motherland, Ukraine, he should have better prospects in terms of finding a job in Ukraine. And we should take it into consideration.
Veterans' rights.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
I've heard you say, and I agree with you, that we've made a lot of progress in fighting corruption and bringing anti-corruption infrastructure. I'll stipulate that. This country is nothing like it was under Yanukovych time. That's for sure. Much better. Yet, I wonder how troubled you are by the current news and the big problems. We have the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine being suspected of leaking information on high-profile criminal investigations to the suspects. And we had that problem with SAPO, the Special Anti-Corruption Prosecutor. We have civil society that just is fundamentally up in arms about, well, that's probably the wrong word, but fundamentally opposed to the presence of Oleh Tatarov as deputy head of the presidential administration, saying we're not going to get rule of law as long as that man is in the presidential administration. Because as we know, he was under investigation. That investigation went nowhere. We have reports of surveillance of journalists. We have reports of investigative journalists after their exposés are being threatened with mobilization. Are you paying attention to that, and what's your assessment?
Yes, absolutely. Me and my colleagues as members of the parliament, as members of our faction, we pay very close attention. And believe me, we discuss sometimes very harshly all these cases. And of course, you know, we're interested in having a good image of Ukraine, because on this image, as a country which is conducting two battles against Russia and against corruption, which is our biggest internal enemy. On the outcome of this battle depends whether we'll be perceived by our partners and allies as trustworthy partner, and whether they will continue to provide us military aid. That's why it's a matter of our survival, the struggle against corruption. But to me, the best sign, the best indicator of success or not success in the fight of corruption is the fact that no one is immune from being brought to justice because of corruption. We have examples when members of parliament were brought to justice.
But who's been convicted in a high-profile case?
So far, I don't have such information. I'm familiar with investigations which are going on.
I know. That's one of our problems, though, too. Investigations dribble on for years and then then go nowhere. Alexander Martinenko, former deputy, is a case in point. Roman Nasirov, the former tax guy chief, is another. You can go. Igor Kolomoisky. We're still picking a Supreme Court. We're still picking a constitutional court. And by the way, Volk, the head of the disbanded Kyiv Administration Court, we're picking a new court there. We are not We are not even halfway on the journey, would you agree, in establishing rule of law?
We need to continue to work in this direction, definitely. I agree with that. And we need to raise the level and trust towards our court system. This is a key.
Which is among the lowest in terms of public trust of any institution.
Unfortunately. You know, to tell you the truth, I lived in the United States for some time, and to me, the object of my admiration has always been your court system. And I would like to see something like that in Ukraine.
It is good. I understand it. And it's good, but we have our own problems right now with the Supreme Court, if you know, right? If you've been following, and I know you follow the news. But it is frustrating. I mean, and I watched this with different administrations. I mean, basically we still have unreformed general prosecutor's office, unreformed SBU, unreformed a lot. I mean, would you be, I know you're an ally and you're in the president's party, and I understand your allegiances, but would you be willing to say, Mr. President, you got to let Tatarov go because he's just too much of an albatross around our neck?
First of all, I trust the president, and I'm trying to remain a loyal member of our team. I believe in teamwork. I'm a team player. And I proceed from the presumption that it is up to the president to decide with whom it is comfortable to work with.
Okay, so you're not going to break on that issue? No.
Personally, I'm not going. But at the same time, it's not within my sort of competence. We have special committee dealing with
anti-corruption
enforcement and anti-corruption. Right. So I trust their point of view because they're specialists.
Right. Yeah, they're not happy either if you look at the news. But we had that, and we had that's a long story. But, you know, I remembered Poroshenko, Yatsenyuk, he'd say, you know, that's not my job, man, that's the president's job. And the president would say, that's not my job, man, that's the prime minister's job. And it would go back and forth like that until, as you know, they completely lost the support of Ukrainian public, which is not stupid, which is quite smart about who's bringing. You weren't surprised. Were you surprised by the 2019 landslide, or you saw it coming?
I was surprised. You see, to me, it was, again, a sign of democracy because we couldn't predict who would win. And I think that I'm happy that the elections were not rigged. We're not rigged.
I think Ukrainians won't tolerate that, right? They
yes.
showed that during the
yeah, absolutely.
Two, three revolutions.
Exactly.
Well,
and the reason, one of the...
The first
one
one's
the
not
reasons.
About the election. Yeah. The second one was. Well, the third one was largely about monopolization
yes.
of power under Yanukovych.
It's a true democracy. It's a true democracy when you have elections with unpredictable results.
Are we going to win this war?
Strategically, we have already won. I can explain why, because as soon as Russian troops were defeated next to Kyiv, it meant the beginning of the end of Putin's regime. And now it's only a question of time, because we managed to preserve our statehood and we kept our capital, Kyiv. So now we are talking about 20% of our territory being occupied, and we are trying to liberate this 20%. But strategically, in the long term, I believe that we have already won, and sooner or later we'll manage. I don't know how long it will take, but in the final analysis, we'll manage to liberate the whole territory of Ukraine.
We'll have to become a big Israel to do that, right?
Yes, perhaps. And we need to continue to have strong will for survival and defense, to have a very high morale. Which luckily we still have. And yes, there is a lot of things which we can learn from Israel, from its experience.
Right. So you're firmly in the camp of no negotiations with Russia. Because you heard Lavrov say the other day, we're not even going to talk until they agree to give up their territory.
I already have experience of negotiating with Russians within the so-called Minsk process. I was deputy head of Ukrainian delegation. And
You were? Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
That must have been an exercise in futility and frustration.
You are absolutely right, because, you know, to me, it was easier to negotiate with the wall than with the Russians, because they even didn't consider themselves to be a party to negotiations. They officially proclaimed themselves to be a mediator, and which was just ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And how can you have any kind of negotiations with a party which doesn't consider itself to be in negotiations? It's a paradox. It's absurdity. So I believe that Russians, you know, what's the use to negotiate with them when you know that no matter which agreement you reach, it will be violated by Russians? They had violated everything. A treaty on friendship and cooperation of 1997, Budapest Memorandum, all kinds of bilateral treaties with Ukraine.
Oh, yeah. 91, 94, 97, as recently as a couple years before 2014, Putin said, Crimea is Ukraine, you know?
Yeah.
So you can't trust there. But, you know, and I know you spent periods studying abroad, but basically, were we asleep from 2014 to 2022, or should we have seen this coming? I mean, I'm searching my brain, and when I read back to the Kyiv Post, when I was the editor, in hindsight, it seems pretty obvious that this is where they were going. Was it that obvious to you, or is it just human nature that we want to wish for the best?
To me, it was not obvious, because, you know, if you would ask me in the year 2013 whether Russia is capable to attack Ukraine, I wouldn't be able to imagine this, for very simple reason, because I'm international lawyer and I believed in the force of international law. I would say, no, how could it happen if there are lots of agreements, if there is a United Nations Security Council, basic principles of international law, the OSCE Council of Europe, but turned out to be that Russian just disregard completely international law.
Which has no enforcement mechanism.
Yes.
And it was kind of broken. So back to the drawing board. Well, I've asked, I think, all my questions, but I want to make sure that you know, if there's anything you want to talk about. Otherwise, we can leave it here.
No, I would like to ask a question, sure. Because, you know, to me, it's very valuable. And I often ask my foreign colleagues how they view the situation, because, you know, we are in the epicenter. We are biased by definition.
We're in a bubble.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes this look from outside, this view from outside can be truly important and sobering sometimes. How do you view the situation right now in Ukraine, and do you have any prognosis how it can develop? For example, next year, what will happen next?
Well, I'm worried because I'm a legal permanent resident and I have deep roots here, and this is my second home. I mean, America is my first home, but this is my home, and I chose to not be a refugee or go back to America. I chose to live here during the full-scale war, so I believe in this country. But I know not everybody cares about us, and that's a big problem. And another thing is there's so many violent spots in the world that aren't even getting attention. We're talking about the Middle East. We're talking about the Uyghurs in China. We're talking about Africa, we're talking about Syria, Darfur in Sudan. So seems a lot of hatred in this world, and I don't think we've really figured that out. The world is heading for multi-trillion-dollar increases in defense spending, and that makes me sad because, well, I agree with it because evil needs to be confronted. You know, that money could go to education, roads, healthcare, everything. And it's not going to go there. And we have to innovate our way out. And I know that we were, at the Kyiv Post, we were strong in corruption, not because we were trying to, you know, run down Ukraine, but because we believe, and I know you believe, and Joe Biden believes, and Tony Blinken believes, that corruption weakens the nation. And you can make the case that corruption weakened us in Ukraine to the point where it made this invasion more likely and more successful than it would have otherwise. So I really want to see that fight be won, and it needs to be won. And I just hope to see that we get that going. I also am the camp that believes Biden is you know, I will vote for him. I'm a Democrat. usually vote for Democrats, although I like John McCain and Mitt Romney and other people. We need to go further. The West plus Ukraine equals victory. Exactly. No question about it. We are so much stronger united against Russia. You can put Russia, China, North Korea, Iran together. They can't touch us if we are united behind Ukraine.
I completely agree with you. I can recall this famous phrase, united we win. Yes, and if we are separated, we fall. So that's why we should keep being united.
Okay. Any more interview questions? I like being interviewed.
Actually, what would be your advice to Ukraine? How to work with American audience? What arguments, how can we persuade them to be more supportive of Ukraine?
Yeah, I think it's happening. Activate diaspora. I know Oksana Makarova for more than a decade, even before she was finance minister. And I hope that Ukraine gets its diplomacy going because it can't just be inside the Beltway. It has to be, you know, in Chicago and Indiana and different states. And I know I come from Minnesota and there's a small but very dynamic diaspora there. So you do that. And we need to, you know, constant education process because, as you know, a lot of Americans have not traveled abroad and they still lump Ukraine and Russia together. So I think we're making progress on that thing. And that was like, it took a war for people to understand that these are really separate countries with really separate ambitions and separate paths and separate tracks. And one is on the track we want to be allies with, and one is something that we want to go back to canon and containment and isolation. And okay, live in your world, but you're not going to live in ours. That's what I think. And I see evidence of that. I think the best evidence is that, you know, America's politics is 50-50. But on the issue of Ukraine, it's bipartisan and a clear majority. Now, that majority fluctuates, but there's still a clear majority. Because why? Because Americans know right from wrong. Now, I know people who say, I don't care about Ukraine. Okay, well, you don't care about Ukraine. But even those people, you have a diplomatic opportunity, because if Ukraine loses, people are starting to wake up like, okay, well, that's going to have some serious consequences, because it means the authoritarians are emboldened, and where are they going to strike next? You know, and you guys are making those arguments, and you guys have very untraditional, I think non-traditional, to reach people who aren't into politics. You know, when you say international rules-based order, that bores a lot of people to tears. And I think Ukraine has the cultural strengths, the historic strengths, the authors, the, you know, the thinkers, the entertainers to make a dent in a country which is really unbelievably split down the middle in terms of politics. That's what I think.
Yes. Thank you.
But I think, you know, it's a good play. It was a great discussion. I'm glad you're in the studio, Alexander Mareshko. I wish you success in your various roles, especially as the head of the Foreign Policy Committee for the Verkhovna Rada. And let's hope we can talk again after the victory.
Yes, absolutely. And the sooner the better.
The sooner the better. I'm all for that. It's been a great discussion. I want to thank all of you for listening and tuning in. You can find us on YouTube, Ukraine Calling. You can find us on the Hromadsky Radio website. And you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, listen in the car, wherever you are. And we'll be back again next week with another great guest and another great episode. Thank you so much.